The AI revolution is taking the world by storm with the release of ChatGPT on November 30th, 2022. ChatGPT is a first-of-its-kind artificial intelligence chatbot made available to the public. In the 5 short months since ChatGPT was released, it is positioning itself to replace the jobs of data analysts, software engineers, paralegals, teachers, accountants, graphic designers, and more. Conservative estimates cite that ChatGPT and other similar artificial intelligence software will replace 300 million jobs in the near future. And for perspective, the U.S. population is 330 million, meaning that an entire nation's worth of jobs will be eradicated by the onslaught of artificial intelligence software. But are there AI-proof jobs that we can begin investing in here and now? Jobs that will not be made obsolete by the continual advent of new technology? Upcoming is an interview with Rory Groves, who delved into this topic himself and authored the book Durable Trades, 61 occupations that have stood the test of time and technological advances and are still in demand to this very day. You can buy the book at shopshepherdist.com and enjoy the interview. And as a spoiler, guys, shepherding is number one on a list of 61 most historically durable trades. All right, guys, welcome. You know how it goes. Give us 2 thumbs up if you can see us and hear us. We are working in the wonderful world of rural Wi-Fi connection and also flies. Sorry, guys. All right, Mr. Groves, thank you for being here. Your book, Durable Trades, it is family-centered economies that have stood the test of time. You are a software engineer turned small-scale farmer. I was incredibly inspired by your story because I am a digital marketer turned shepherdess. I want you to speak to something that kind of scared me, and it was obsolescence as a result of automation and robotics. What have you seen in recent years, and what are we facing in the next maybe even couple decades?
This is my world, is automation and artificial intelligence and technology and coding. This is kind of the direction things are headed, is this constant pursuit of centralization, of efficiency. And computer algorithms are incredibly efficient, right? They work 24 hours a day. Yeah, so you're going to continue to see this drive to replace humans with automation.
Yes.
I think there's a stat in the book that 47% of all knowledge worker professions are expected to become replaced by computer algorithms in the next 10 to 15 years. And at the same time, they're expected to see a 30% increase in the building trades over the same time period. So those kind of professions are very susceptible. And artificial intelligence and algorithmic automation, those are real. That stuff is happening now. It's replaced already a lot of people in a lot of jobs. And we do see an increase in efficiency, which relates to an increase in material abundance.
Right.
But we haven't seen the kind of exponential growth in job replacement that we're about to see. Over the next 10 to 15 years, we're expecting a massive shift, 800 million workers around the world being displaced from the jobs they're currently employed at.
Wow. And I think that you mentioned something, that just because a job is high paying does not mean it's durable. Speak to that a little bit, because that really struck me.
Yeah. So the thing is with automation is that they target the high paying jobs. I mean, that's where you're going to get the most return on your investment. If it's a low paying job, it's easier to hire a human to do it, especially if it's custom work. If you're replacing countertops in a house and every house is different, it's going to be really hard to get a robot to figure out how to do all those custom enhancements. And by the way, that's not a low paying job. Cabinetry is a very high paying job. But there are a lot of professions, knowledge worker professions, I'm talking about doctors and lawyers and teachers, all kinds of knowledge work, computer programmers like myself. Those can be very high paying jobs, but those also become ripe for automation because you're leveraging the most return on investment if you can automate that job. There's a lawyer that I interviewed for the book, and the anecdote isn't in the book, but he mentioned that he was talking to another gentleman about his job in the legal profession and how custom it is and how he feels secure in his job. And the gentleman, who was a business owner, told him, "You don't get it. When we have a legal dispute, I send it over to the legal team in India, And the next morning, a dossier is prepared. It is on my computer with all of the U.S. law references and the response and the rebuttals and the court filings to file. I never have to contact a U.S. attorney for any of my legal needs anymore.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, just one example. And of course, computer programming has seen the same kind of automation. We've seen a lot of the jobs get outsourced to India, to China. It's not as acute as how manufacturing has been outsourced.
Yeah.
Because there's still so much more demand for computer programming. So there's always going to be demand for someone stateside to do that kind of work. But trust me, this is my world. I mean, as soon as they can outsource the core programming logic, they will. And as soon as machines can do it automatically, they will.
Yeah. All right. Rachel asked if I would show people how to enter the giveaway. I am giving away one copy of Durable Trades to anyone who takes a picture of the screen, posts it to whatever social channel you have, tagging at Harmony Farms Dorpers. Make sure to let me know you entered. And I will be choosing one of you to receive a copy of Durable Trades by Rory Groves. So you have in this book, Durable Trades, which is available at shopshepherdess.com. If you guys want to get your copy. You have a list of 61 durable trades. Can you tell us what went into compiling that list and what criteria you used to actually make sure a job made the list or didn't?
Sure. So the way I came up with these trades that are in the book is I decided to kind of set a test and a limit, like what has been the most durable professions in history and the most family-centered. And the way I did that is I looked at before the Industrial Revolution, what trades were around. So about 230 years ago was the founding of our country. So right about the same time was the kind of beginning of the Industrial Revolution. When that came on the scene, it radically changed the way that humans work and human societies function. And it happened gradually, but it was really looking back at it from like a sociological perspective, it was very rapid. In the course of two or three generations, it was almost a total upheaval about the way we work and the way we think about work, the way we think about money.
Yeah.
And so what I did is I looked at all the professions that were existing before the Industrial Revolution and are still existing today as the main test of what is durable. Because if it has survived for that period of time, it means it's survived, obviously, revolutions, it's war, inflation, currency devaluation, pandemics. It survived changes of forms of government. So there's so many factors that if it has survived over that period of time, then it means it's going to be at least very durable if it doesn't continue to survive for the long haul.
Now, touching in on the Industrial Revolution, why do you use that as a placeholder historically?
So I chose, you know, America from 1790 to present, because that was really where our perspective on work changed, our perspective on how societies function, the centralization into cities happened, the urbanization happened in the 19th century. So prior to that, you're really looking at a very different type of agrarian age in which people had subsisted for thousands of years. So in other words, most of the trades that are in this book, if they existed prior to the Industrial Revolution, almost all of them existed thousands of years before that. So very long-term, very permanent and durable and sustainable and resilient to different kinds of shocks in the system. Whereas during the Industrial Revolution, what you saw, you know, I mentioned in the book, you mentioned at the beginning of the show, there's over 30,000 occupations today. Well, back in 1790, 1800, there were maybe a total of about 70 occupations total. I mean, imagine, you know, starting out in life and you have basically a few dozen occupations to choose from. It was pretty comprehensible to take on those kind of challenges. Whereas today it's just bewildering. You don't know when you're picking a college career or a college major, which one is going to be around. And that has been the case since the Industrial Revolution, where thousands of different jobs and careers have been created and then destroyed by the same revolution.
So Anthony asks a good question. Have you found a common denominator? Is there a common denominator on the 61 trades listed in this book?
Yes, definitely. One of the common denominators are that trades catering to food, fiber, and shelter, so like the core human needs, are the most resilient over time. 4 of the top 5 trades and 12 of the top 20 are all related to food, fiber, and shelter. And at the bottom of the list, even though they're very durable and they've been long lasting, only 1 in 20 of the bottom are related to food, fiber, and shelter. And so you see in the bottom of the list, you tend to see more entertainment oriented or athletic oriented or kind of services oriented professions. But at the top of it, it just continues to be providing those core basic needs that people need. And then the second consistent theme would be family centeredness. So the family centered trades, the ones that basically involved all ages, that had a place for people, for a whole family to work together in, are also the most durable and the most resilient. So those ones also prioritize towards the top.
So Joel asks a question and he says, how can we use artificial intelligence, leveraging it as small farmers? Do you see a way to do that in good balance?
You know, right now, most of the data intelligence or artificial intelligence is coming in the way of managing databases of information. So the best bet is going to be in terms of utilizing information for farming is going to be in the sense of deep database diving, you know, where big data, where they're able to merge many, many multiple histories of databases together and glean some kind of new information. But you tend to employ that not as a small farmer, as a small anything. It tends to be in the massive types of industrial applications where a few percentage points of efficiency will give you a competitive edge. So in the sense of the small farmers, I mean, there is going to be a small but growing space for robotics in farming. You know, you can think of like the Roomba vacuum cleaner that does some of the grunt work. Well, they have tractors now that have been, at least in the university level, employed to farm a parcel of land from beginning to end for the whole season. So you're going to see more things like drone tractors. Yeah. You already have GPS-controlled tractors with the farmers in them, for the most part. So that kind of thing will continue to be there. But I think for the small-scale farmer, you're going to want to look for value in different ways. You don't want to put yourself up against the massive commercial farmers who are farming 8,000-10,000 acres and utilizing some of this technology. You're going to want to be focusing on building relationships with your customers. That's something that robots will never be able to do.
So I'm going to ask you about your scoring metrics with respect to durable trades. Can you talk about those and how you, well, what they are first and foremost, what are they?
As I started to research this, I wanted to know not just what trades were durable, but which ones were the most durable and the most family-centered. Because this was originally just a project for my own family. I wanted to know what the options were for someone like me who was kind of fed up with the high technology and everything going obsolete all the time. So I wanted to know what are my options before I make a decision like this. And what I did is I broke it up into 5 categories. So we have historical stability, family-centeredness, resiliency, which basically means how quickly does a profession recover from shocks, like a recession or a depression. Like these are always going to affect different cycles, but some professions, they go away and never come back. Income, so that's basically what does it pay? And then the last one is ease of entry. So those are the 5 categories, and I scored each trade according to those categories. So let's say, for example, family centeredness. To get the score on family centeredness, I asked, is there opportunities for children and elderly people to work in the profession with you? Can it be a home-based profession, or does it have to be off-site? Does it leave tangible assets for future generations? You know, there are some professions that are, they're total information jobs, they're knowledge work. And besides the money that you might sock away, there's not actually any hard assets to pass on. Whereas if you're involved in a profession like farming, I mean, you have land, you have equipment, you have bloodlines and the animals that you're raising. So that's just one example. But there were in all about 25 questions that I asked of each profession. And they, based on that, it came up with a composite score. And I put that at the end of every chapter in the book. So you can kind of see where each trade ranks against the other trades.
That's good. Guys, if you could put in the comments, are you full-time farmers or do you also have an off-farm job? Leave it in the comments. I am curious to know what you do. in addition to this farming. I am a digital marketer. For the past 10 years, I have been building websites and businesses on the internet. When I told my family I wanted to start raising livestock, and when they saw me out in the middle of the pasture measuring it for rotational grazing, they had thought I was going a little bit off the deep end. But really, honestly, this was a prayer of mine to have eyes to see an undervalued asset. When I became interested in agriculture and grassland agriculture specifically, I didn't realize that maybe this was an answer to that prayer, because I really do believe that trades like this and work like this is undervalued. It's durable in a way that a lot of what we have today is not. Kevin Powell asks, where does mowing yards stack up in the list of 61 durable trades?
Well, is it on the list? Maybe you could swing gardener in that. Gardener is one of the trades. Yeah, so you could get, people who are into landscaping. The guy I interviewed for Gardner, his name is Paul Gauci. And I don't know, have you ever heard of Paul Gauci, Grace?
No.
Okay.
No.
Highly recommend the documentary called Back to Eden Film, or just Back to Eden. If you Google that, it's a free documentary. It features a man named Paul Gauci up in the Olympic Peninsula of Washington. And he gardens with a deep mulch method, and it's fascinating what he has developed over the years. And it's the same system that we use here now, and it works fantastic. It works in all climates. But he is a gardener, and he also is an arborist, and that's his main job. And he has always had steady work his entire life. Anywhere he lives, anywhere he goes, people who are, you know, skilled at pruning trees or taking care of landscapes, they seem to always be in demand. So that maybe you could swing lawn mowing.
I think you could. Sure. Kevin, you are not a lawnmower. You are a gardener. I want you to relabel yourself right now. And your trade, I think, is very durable. All right. Unless people get into regenerative agriculture and start grazing their yards, then you've got some competition.
Well, yep, there's that option too.
All right. So Anthony asks you personally, what is the end goal for your farm? Is it only to support your family and in a homestead situation? Or do you think you will make an aggressive effort to expand it into an occupational situation?
Our main goal is providing the needs for our own family. That's always the number one goal, is self-sufficiency. We want to be more connected to the land, but also providing as much as we can from our own land first. And I say that in a sense that before we're looking at the market value of the things that we're doing, because what I've tended to find is that as soon as you leave the farm and try to monetize the products of the farm, you're in this huge sea of competition, and it's very, very difficult to actually get an edge in that marketplace. But we get an incredible amount of value out of providing for our own family. And I mean, we have healthy food, we have stocked freezers, we have the enjoyment of raising the animals. We know what goes into our food. You know, we have control over that supply chain. So if there's ever any disruptions at the grocery store, I mean, people are talking about the price of beef at the grocery store. Honestly, I don't even know what the price of beef at the grocery store is, because we raise all our own meat, or we buy it from other farmers who are raising it just like we are.
Right.
So there's so many really valuable options or valuable value propositions if you're doing it for your own family first. And the second aspect is, you know, you do have to earn money and you have to pay bills. And so how do you get around that? For us, our focus is, like I had said, kind of agrotourism. So we see the educational opportunity of all of this as being something that we would like to increase and try to bring more people and expose more people to this and kind of help other people get started in the same journey.
That's a really good point, in that sort of the opportunity that springboarded off of your farming operation may create a unique income stream for you. It's not necessarily selling your meat, but you're providing an experience and an education from your farm, and that's generating a bit of an income. Danielle asks, how do you market or connect with other families who are interested in a family-centered economy?
Great question. That's kind of part of the purpose of what we're doing right now, is trying to connect people. If you don't mind, if I could share my website. The Grovestead. Yeah, thegrovestead.com. This book really represents what we feel called to do, which is connecting families who are trying to start family-centered economies and trying to support each other in that. And in that way, small farmers are a huge, they play a huge role in that because they get it. They understand that you need to have resilient food systems and you need to have control over the supply chain in order to have resiliency. But there are many other family-centered economies and home economies, people who are trying to build those that are very interested, but they don't know where to start because in a lot of ways, no one's for you in the sense that you have either the corporations that are interested in separating families to work in the corporations, or you have governments which are interested in keeping people dependent on the government. So we write about a lot of this, these topics, and then we have events. In fact, we're going to be having an event in August, at the end of August, and it's purely about this topic. And we're the whole goal of the event is trying to bring people together to meet one another and encourage one another in building their home economies.
That's good. All right, so guys, thegrovestead.com. I'll make sure to follow up with this, with all the ways you can get in touch with Mr. Groves after this meetup. All right, so this is kind of a, I wanted to make sure to get this question in before we closed out here.
Greg says AI mower that does fence lines. That I think I could
Okay,
adopt that because that's one of the things I end up doing. So
this is
I
an
like that.
idea for anybody who might be a developer out there. I would like something that's a Roomba for the pasture that'll go under my electric fence and get
There
brush
we go.
encroachment. I would
I like
tolerate
that.
that. Anyways, so in 2021, Bill Gates became the largest owner of US farmland with a 269,000 acre portfolio. Should the centralization of farmland ownership be a matter of concerns for Americans or American small farmers? Why or why not?
You know, I did spend the first part of my career working with Microsoft technology, so I'm familiar with Bill Gates. I don't know in terms of the policy level how much this impacts, or if it's nothing more than just in place that where he's holding his money, because he's an incredibly wealthy man. You know, Ted Turner has 2 million acres, so it's not farmland, mostly ranch land, but I think that there's a number of different concerns that are out there and that are always going to be out there about what's going on a national or a world scale and about different people that are aggressively doing things that might impact you. And I think that it's important to stay focused on what you are doing on your little patch of dirt. In other words, if God has called you to do something important for your family and for your community and to build those relationships or to grow healthy food or to just to show, just to live a different life and show people that there is a different way to do this. I think that if you stay focused on that, you'll be busy enough that you won't really need to worry too much about what's going on in the larger world. I'm not saying that you keep your head in the sand, but I'm saying that God has a way through his providence of looking out for those who are following his will. And there's a protection and a safety in that. My immediate answer to that is that, you know, you can be informed, be aware, focus on the local issues in your local community first. Also be aware that there's a lot of people that are trying to stir up a lot of things all the time. And you can really waste time getting upset about things that you have no control over. But if you can really create a beautiful life and a beautiful family where you are, you're going to do so much more for the world. And you're going to be provided for by the Lord. He's going to protect you.
That's really good. I think there's a lot of understandable anxiety surrounding the topic, and that is really something we need to hone in on. Whatever we have, if it's a front yard, if it's a backyard, if it's 10 acres or 30 acres, just being as faithful with what we've been given as possible.
Amen.
There was a quote in the back of the book, and it brought light to the fact that there are easier ways to acquire food, cleaner ways, cheaper food, but that's not why we do it. Could you summarize as we close here? In 7 minutes, what has it done for your family? Bringing it back to a personal level, why do you do it if there are cheaper ways?
Yeah, you're referring to one of the essays in the back of the book about kind of a reflection on why are we working so hard when you can just go to the store and buy tomatoes for,
Exactly.
you know, a couple dollars? Why do we put a whole season of work in for it? And one of the things that I learned over the course of living here and in attempting this lifestyle, and I know that you have too, because you come from a similar background and you're you're out there in the grass with sheep. So there is a fulfillment in this connectedness with the land that it's just hard to explain. It kind of has its own influence on you. And while we're here, we're working together as a family. And it's one of those rare places that I can do that, that we can actually put our hands together and grow things together or raise things together, take care of the land, and then enjoy the fruit of the land. I mean, all winter long, we're enjoying the maple syrup that we evaporate from our own maple trees. And so there's so many aspects on this farm where, yeah, it would be cheaper if we were to go buy it from a store, but we would miss that opportunity to build these strong relationships with our children who are here with us.
Yeah.
We homeschool, we have 5 children and we homeschool our children. So we make that part of their education. It's just everything that we're learning here, we're passing that on to them. Mm-hmm. And it's a, for us and as a believer, it's an opportunity to disciple our children. We get to show them the ways of God through nature, through his own creation. And mm-hmm. I think there's no better way to illustrate the providence of God and the provision of God and how much we really depend on the Lord in other than in a farming context where you're mm-hmm. completely dependent on him and you see the rhythms of nature and the rhythms of the Bible all throughout the property and all throughout the land.
I think that's one of our downfalls is that we isolate the definition of values to dollar and cents, really. And that
yes.
could be why we're here today in a lot of ways. Mr. Groves, where can people find you on the internet if they want to get in touch with you to see more of what you are doing?
Our website, thegrovestead.com, is kind of where we put everything. And then we have a print newsletter that we send out quarterly. We're actually working on the next issue right now. Today we've been working on it. So that's going to go out pretty soon. You can sign up to that. It's free. And then we have an Instagram if you want to follow more of the day-to-day. My wife likes to keep people busy with pictures and the kids and different fun things going on around the farm. So that would just be at the Grovestead on Instagram.
All right. Great, guys. You can follow me as Harmony Farms Dorpers on Instagram. But first, follow me at harmonyfarms.blog and subscribe to my newsletter there. This has been a great meetup. Give us a thumbs up, guys, if you enjoyed this time with Mr. Groves. Thank you, everyone, for attending. This has been a wonderful time. Until next time, thank you all.